This is tongue-in-cheek, Better Off Alone.
A countryside becomes a landscape insofar as it is a coherent whole with its own characteristics. But this can happen only when it becomes the experience of a human soul. If the soul recognizes the rhythm of the countryside as its own rhythm. For each people and each race, a countryside thus becomes its own peculiar landscape. The landscape is something objective, neutral, and becomes of value only when we see it through our own spirit. It attains value through the strength of the life of our own soul, the vessel of which the landscape becomes the object.
जाओ जी मन बीत कराओ जी रा क्यों तरसावे हो मन सकल दिखाओ जी थारी शरारत सब जानू मैं चौधरी हर सले उन भंगा दी मैं कह लगे मर बिगड़े में जागी दो कणी चंदा में थारी चांदनी मन दामन में पा सीरे झुम 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 ओ मारे इगड़े में जागी धोकनी चंदा में थारी चांदनी मन दामन में बाधी खुशीरे झुम 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 झुम
So this is an example of contemporary Rajasthani folk music from India. It's by Amit Trivedi featuring Mame Khan. And much Rajasthani folk music traditionally adheres to different ragas, which are specific melodic frameworks for improvisation. Each raga is an array of melodic structures with musical motifs, and they're considered in the Indian tradition to have the ability to color the mind and affect the emotions of the audience. So often, Indian music has discussions of its color, you know, or like when it's reinterpreted, it will often, you know, people will often think about how that color was affected. Traditionally, these Rajasthani musicians only sing specific ragas at designated times of the day or in particular seasons. And they have different ragas and songs reserved for all occasions, such as weddings, births, etc. So they serve to sort of announce or accompany a different time, specific time in the day or one's life. So Rajasthani folk music was once pretty confined and unique to different regions and locales, and it's grown to see musicians work with international pop stars, Bollywood productions. The regional specificity has somewhat blurred as well, and ragas, which traditionally accompanied particular events in one's days or lifetime, are now often sung together in a single performance. And Rajasthani performers often include popular Bollywood music in their performances as a way to appeal to broader audiences.
This next cheer is a great cheer to use when you're trying to get your crowd motivated, because it gives them an opportunity to yell out and cheer with you. We're going to start out stepping our right foot forward and bringing our right arm up from a straight position to here. So this is going to be yell out. So let's try that. Yell out. We're going to go ahead and do the exact same thing on the other side. Your colors, bobcats. Then we're going to hit green. We're going to step out into a wide stance. Our left arm is going to go on our hip. Our right arm is going to go across. Make sure you don't cover up your eyes or your mouth. Let's take that from the top. Yell out your colors, bobcats, green. For and, we're just going to switch it from a cross high V to a low V. Let's take that from the top. Yell out your colors, bobcats, green. And for gold, we're going to take our right arm and put it on our hip while our left arm pops out into the high V position. So let's take that from the top. Yell out your colors, bobcats, green, and gold. Make sure when we're going from the green and, we want to keep this motion sharp. Even though it's a circle, we want to make sure we hit here and hit here. Let's go ahead and show you the reverse of it. Yell out your colors, bobcats, green, and gold. So even though it's a circle, keep it nice and stiff, and you've got a great crowd-pleasing cheer.
Volk is one of those perplexing German terms which connotes far more than its specific meaning. Volk is a much more comprehensive term than people. For to German thinkers, ever since the birth of German Romanticism in the late 18th century, Volk signified the union of a group of people with a transcendental essence. This essence might be called nature, or cosmos, or mythos, but in each instance it was fused to a man's innermost nature and represented the source of his creativity, his depth of feeling, his individuality, and his unity with other members of the Volk.
Inferred solution hoods. So here's a scenario. I'm on an airplane halfway through the flight. It's a full flight. I call the stewardess over. She walks down the aisle towards me, stops and kneels down, asking, "What can I do for you?" I respond, "I'm uncomfortable in this chair. Let's fix this." So, inferred solution hoods. It's essentially a term, a rhetorical term, or a term from linguistics that is a type of interpropositional relation, which actually means a relationship between two clauses or two propositions within the same phrase. So the two phrases being, I am doing something, or I am in this state, let's do this other thing. And what I think there's a couple different things that, we find interesting about this kind of phrase, this particular thing called an inferred solution hood, just under the construction of I am let's. And so I just wanted to, let's just open it up for a second to talk about that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, for me personally, the I am let's is going from something that is a personally owned sensation or personally owned, let's say, discomfort. Like I'm sitting on an airplane and my seat's uncomfortable, and I'm the only one sitting in this particular seat. But then I put it upon somebody else, extend myself to somebody else to say, let's collectively solve this problem that I am experiencing.
Yeah, it sort of steamrolls over whatever they may be experiencing or feeling to try and synchronize your respective behaviors to solve your problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, could be you're out at a party and you're like, I'm tired, let's go home. I guess it's for people who don't want to or can't solve problems themselves.
But it's something that infects like all of our language.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sort of rhetoric that I think is probably pretty, I don't know. When I think of it, I think of the workplace, like a boss saying like, let's do this or let's do this. And, you know, what they really mean is you do this.
Right.
Because I don't want to.
Right. And I don't want to state exactly what I want.
Yeah, exactly. It's, yeah, I don't know. It's like this sort of effort to create a shared subjectivity. So it doesn't actually sound, it doesn't sound like you're doing what you're actually doing, which is making somebody else do something.
It's sort of like a passive collective in some funny way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a sort of, I mean, in a bigger picture, I think of it as like a homogenization of human activity. It's asking other people to do the same thing you're doing. In a weird sort of primordial way, I think that's what like a yawn is. That we have this reflexive response when people yawn to ourselves yawn, just like and it's thought that wolves howling is similar, that you know it's just a way to collectivize behavior. And synchronize something as simple as a sleep schedule. And it's interesting how it continues into language, but in a much more conscious way.
Yeah, I think it's that's so embedded in the term like solution hood, right? Like as if there is a pact that's being kind of inferred or enforced or pushed upon other people to bring a solution or solve one's individual state.
Yeah.
And I think it's also not so far from speaking on the radio and sort of trying to lead others through something on the radio.
Yeah, absolutely. Because of the nature of its one-way communication. I mean, if you can call it communication, because it's one way, you're merely broadcasting your state and other people sort of receive it. There's no response or, I mean,
right. Even it's just a communication between the I am and the let's, right? Between the singular and the singular plural.
Yeah. yeah, it's a sort of just like the when it happens in language, it's a device that turns just like a singular need into a collective need, just like radio as a technology or as a device turns something that exists in one locale or in one person into something that exists in many. Mm.
I am hungry. Let's go to Japonica. I am sad. Let's go to therapy. I am tired. Let's go to bed. I am confused. Let's read that again. I am hot. Let's take our clothes off. I am cold. Let's put on our jackets. I am bored. Let's go to that party. I don't like these toys. Let's find different toys. I am full. Let's stop eating. I am lonely.
Let's leave it at that.
And cannot man have self-esteem if he loves his fellow man? What's wrong with loving your fellow man? Christ, every important moral leader in man's history, has taught us that we should love one another. Why, then, is this kind of love, in your mind, immoral?
It is immoral if it is a love placed above oneself. It is more than immoral. It's impossible. Because when you are asked to love everybody indiscriminately, that is, to love people without any standard, to love them regardless of the fact of whether they have any value or virtue, you are asked to love nobody.
But in a sense, in your book, you talk about love as if it were a business deal of some kind. Isn't the essence of love that it is above self-interest?
Let me make it concrete for you. What would it mean to have love above self-interest? It would mean, for instance, that a husband would tell his wife, if he were moral, according to the conventional morality, that I am marrying you just for your own sake. I have no personal interest in it, but I am so unselfish that I am marrying you only for your own good.
Well, should husbands and wives
tally up? Would any woman like that?
Should husbands and wives, Ayn, tally up at the end of the day and say, well, now, wait a minute. I love her if she's done enough for me today, or she loves me if I have properly performed my functions.
No, you misunderstood me. That is not how love should be treated. I agree with you that it should be treated like a business deal, but every business has to have its own terms and its own kind of currency. And in love, the currency is virtue. You love people not for what you do for them or what they do for you. You love them for the values, the virtues, which they have achieved in their own character. You don't love causelessly. You don't love everybody indiscriminately. You love only those who deserve it.
And then if a man is weak or a woman is weak, then he is beyond love?
He certainly does not deserve it. He certainly is beyond. He can always correct it. Man has free will. If a man wants love, he should correct his weaknesses or his flaws, and he may deserve it. But he cannot expect the unearned, neither in love, nor in money,
but you
neither
have,
in matter nor spirit.
You have lived in our world, and you recognize the fallibility of human beings. There are very few of us, then, in this world, by your standards, who are worthy of love.
Unfortunately, yes, very few. But it is open to everybody to make themselves worthy of it, and that is all that my morality offers them.
If they will
conduct a way to make themselves worthy of love, although that's not the primary motive.
I wish everyone could see the music video for that. Apropos to our earlier playing the Rajasthani folk music, this pop song has Alice DJ dancing around in saris and bindis and she's belly dancing, actually. It's a strange fusion of Middle Eastern and South Asian culture.
Okay, an exercise, a greeting exercise for our listeners and us. So here's another scenario. We'll do this first exercise, the greeting exercise, in a casual greeting or a casual welcome, and then we'll do one later with a formal welcome. So here's a scenario. You have just knocked on my door, at home, and I'm going to read one part of a dialogue. And then there'll be a pause for you, our listener, to respond. And before each of my my parts, Aaron is actually going to give us an analysis or give me a sort of prompt of what to say and how to say it in this guided, casual welcome. So again, you've knocked on my door. And I'm going to casually welcome you. So Aaron will prompt us. I'll read my part, wait for you to respond, and then Aaron will prompt the next.
Yes, respond to the radio. Act surprised and end phrase with nice to see you. Surprise.
Oh, hi. Come in. It's really nice to see you.
Say back to them whatever they said to you and insist to do something they can thank you for. Mirror and insist.
Thanks. So are you. Let me take your coat.
Guide them somewhere and offer them something. Guide their knowledge.
Come through to the living room and make yourself at home. What can I get you for a drink?
Give them options of a gift or something you have and they don't. Present options.
I've made some fresh tea, but you can also have coffee or hot chocolate.
Ask their preference within the option of the gift. Preference.
How do you take your tea?
Smigop. Smigop. Mirror and insist. Guide their knowledge. Present options and preferences. The aim of a casual welcome is to leave an individual alone momentarily in a place familiar to you. For them to do as they wish without you watching. Now, continuing on without analysis.
Here we go, your tea and some homemade cookies. You're welcome. How was your trip? Excellent. How is your mom? It's a shame she couldn't be here today. Well, next time, I hope. Lunch will be ready soon. We thought we could go for a walk around town afterwards. You haven't really seen much of the town, have you?
Malanga, 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 Malan
Dama Dam Maskalandar, which is one of the oldest and most well-known poems in Sufi Islamic folk music. Many times throughout its history, I think it was first written in the 13th century, but many times throughout its history, it's been reconceived by different composers and musicians, at which times it's said that its color has changed, sort of going back to what we were saying earlier about the raga and the color and its ability to affect the emotional tone of an audience. So what we're about to play is a pop reinterpretation of it made for the Bollywood movie Hey Baby.
Second exercise. Now we're going to go back to the formal greeting, sorry, to the greeting, but do it formal instead of casual. So again, where you have a scenario, instead of you coming and knocking on my door, you have just come through the elevator to my office, and you're going to respond to me formally. And again, before I read my part or speak my part, Aaron's going to give us an analysis of the construction of a welcome.
Okay. By contrast to a casual greeting, don't act surprised. Show that you have been expecting them. Close every mention of time with a contained amount of time, and every phrase with a period. Expect.
Good morning. Do come in. Welcome. It's nice to see you again.
Say that your collective empathizes with the individual, and as that collective, offer to do something for that one individual. Agree and ask.
So have we. May we take your coat?
Show that they have freedom in your set constraints. Comfort and constrain.
Please have a seat and make yourself comfortable. Would you like tea or coffee?
Show they have options within their constrained freedoms. Present options.
How would you like your coffee?
By contrast to MIGOP, M-I-G-O-P, which is mirror and insist, guide their knowledge, present options and preferences, in a formal setting, use IACO, or IAGO, that is, expect, agree and ask, comfort and constrain, and present options. The aim of a formal welcome is to make the individual feel a part of a collective by making them feel they have freedoms in a limited scope. Now, continuing on without analysis.
Here you are. Please help yourself to the cookies. You're welcome. Do you have any trouble finding the way? Excellent. How is Mr. Lehman? It's a pity he couldn't join us today. Send our regards. Well, I certainly hope he can join you on your next visit. As for today's schedule, we thought we could have lunch first and then show you around the company. How does that sound to you?
And how do we keep our balance? That I can tell you in one word. Tradition!
Tradition! Tradition!
Of our traditions. We've kept our balance for many, many years. Here in Anatevka, we have traditions for everything. How to sleep, how to eat, how to work, how to wear clothes. For instance, we always keep our heads covered and always wear a little prayer shawl. This shows our constant devotion to God. You may ask, how did this tradition get started? I'll tell you. I don't know. But it's a tradition. And because of our tradition, every one of us knows who he is and what God expects him to do.
Who day and night must scramble for a living, feed a wife and children, say his daily prayers, and who has a right as master of the house to have the final word at home? The papa!
So, roticity is, it refers to, in English, the pronunciation of the historic rhotic consonant, which is just R, by speakers of English. In non-rhotic varieties of English, speakers no longer pronounced R in what's called a post-vocalic environment. That is, when it's immediately after a vowel and not followed by another vowel. So that would be English as we know it in like South England, where the R is dropped.
Butter.
Yes, butter.
Butter. Butter. Butter.
For example, a rhotic English speaker pronounces the words hard and butter as hard and butter, whereas a non-rhotic speaker drops or deletes the R sound, pronouncing them as hard and butter. In non-rhotic English, a speaker usually still pronounces the R in the phrase butter and jam, which is known as a linking R, because the R is followed by a vowel. It wouldn't really make sense to drop it. It makes it easier to say to keep the R in that circumstance. So evidence from written documents suggests that this dropping of the R began sporadically during the mid-15th century, although these R-less spellings were pretty uncommon and they are restricted to private documents. In the mid-1700s, post-vocalic R throughout the English Empire was still pronounced in most situations. But by the 1740s to the 1770s, it was almost entirely deleted. So the British, up until this point, pronounced their R's much like Americans do now. And British colonists migrating to America at the time carried this original English accent over to the colonies, and the American colonial accent carried it on, continuing to pronounce the post-vocalic R. By the early 1800s, the Southern British standard fully transformed into this non-rhotic variety that we now know, where they don't say the R. The variation is referred to as received pronunciation, or also BBC English. This loss of post-vocalic R in British English influenced Southern and Eastern American port cities with close connections to Britain, causing their upper-class pronunciations to become non-rhotic, dropping the R, while the rest of the United States remained rhotic.
Whoa.
Think of a Boston accent or a Louisiana drawl, which I won't even attempt right now. Non-rhotic pronunciation continued to influence American prestige speech until the 1860s, when the American Civil War began to shift America's centers of wealth and political power to rhotic areas with fewer cultural connections to the old colonial and British elites. The advent of radio and television in the 20th century established a national standard of American pronunciation that preserves the historical pronunciation of R's, with rhotic speech in particular becoming prestigious in the United States rapidly after the Second World War.
Repeat after me. Him.
Him.
Handbag.
Handbag.
Harbinger.
Harbinger.
Her.
Her.
Herring.
Herring.
Hand.
Hand.
Handsome.
Handsome.
Hiss.
Hiss.
Handy.
Handy.
Harlot.
Harlot.
Happy.
Happy.
Haircut.
Haircut.
Hunter.
Hunter.
Heavy.
Heavy.
Hat.
Hat.
Handkerchief.
Handkerchief.
Happle.
Happle.
Horse.
Horse.
Hang.
Hang.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Horticulture.
Horticulture.
Hairdresser.
Hairdresser.
Head.
Head.
Hunderbelly.
Hunderbelly.
Heft.
Heft.
How.
How.
Held.
Held.
Access.
Access.
Holiday.
Holiday.
Heart.
Heart.
Hope.
Hope.
Harm.
Harm.
Hint.
Hint.
Hex.
Hex.
Hercules.
Hercules.
Huge.
Huge.
Happenstance.
Happenstance.
Hurriedly.
Hurriedly.
Hypocrite.
Hypocrite.
Impossible.
Impossible.
Ha.
Ha.
Horrendous.
Horrendous.
Hot.
Hot.
Hernia.
Hernia.
Elbow.
Elbow.
Hearth.
Hearth.
Have.
Have.
The evolution of jazz. This orchestra would be horrified at the thought of changing a single note or of suppressing the slightest sigh in this largo of Handel. Respect of the written notes is one of the essential conditions of all classical interpretations, but not so with jazz. If we say, I have just heard Handel's Largo, we also say, I have just heard a record by Armstrong, by Coleman Hawkins, by Jack Teagarden, or by Benny Goodman. Why this difference? In jazz music, the execution is more important than the composition. How it is played is what counts, not how it is written. The melodic theme serves as a bare background for the intricate variations of the hot jazz player, and the value of the piece depends on the quality of the interpretation. Until about 1926, jazz music was played straight. That is, the melodic theme was more or less respected and each air was played as written, such as, for instance, this one. Then jazz, little by little, lost its coldness, and straight jazz became hot, thanks to a few musicians whose remarkable improvisations gave jazz a new lease on life. Listen to Django Reinhardt. It is the same melody, but what a difference in interpretation. These three musicians will represent two guitars and a bass fiddle. Finally, here is Stefan Grappelli, virtuoso violinist of hot jazz. The magic strings of the instruments of these five musicians was formed the quintet of the Hot Club of France.
Hypercorrections. Whom? Whom should be used as the object of a clause, not as the subject. Who is a subject?
Whom is an object?
Whom are you?
Whom are me? I should be used as the subject of a clause, not as the object. I is a subject. Me is an object.
You heard I.
You hear I.
Jerry Morrow is not satisfied. He's not satisfied at his job and not satisfied with his music. He doesn't have enough time to do what he wants to do. His concerns are mainly with his family, his neighbors, and his health. Just like the rest of us, he watches TV and has the need to buy the things that are advertised. What marks him is his music. Through it, he is connected to an earlier tradition. The fiddle and its music, this is more important to him than anything else. It's something that comes from him and something he can pass on.
I live in the town of Woodland. I can see the mill right out through the window. It's a small town. Most of the people here work in the mill. So they just stay here because you just can't pick up and leave and buy a house somewhere else because you just don't have all that money. I start my day off by taking care of my little girl. She's 8 months old. It's a pretty big job to take care of her, dressing her and bathing her and feeding her and teaching her things, talking to her, playing with her. She likes to have a bath. She likes to go outdoors, too. She likes to listen to Jerry play the fiddle. The first music that I heard was probably my Mo and Jerry playing the fiddle and accordion. I listen to country and western, but I don't really like it that much.
You've heard Archaic Dance by Drudk, Landschaft und Seele by Otto Gmelin, Chaudhary by Amit Trivedi featuring Mame Khan, Ayn Rand, Better Off Alone by Alice DJ, Dama Dam Maskalandar by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan.
So how did you two meet?
Fiddler on the Roof.
I don't know. What color dress was
she wearing? Je Tendra by Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli.
That's a long way.
Thank you for listening to Tongue in Cheek.
Shitty boomer.
Well,
that was all right.
Was that because
they
made
me? Good with nothing more.
Marilyn and their friend Dennis perform with the country band at the Moosehorn Lodge. The country songs have become kitchen music in Down East Maine.